Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for February 7, 2019. Many topics to cover tonight. And I'll be talking about some monetary systems, very interesting. But first of all, it turns out that this July 20th, 1969, we were told that NASA landed men on the moon. So all I'm saying, I'm not going to go into that at all. All I'm saying is get ready for the hoopla, the 50-year anniversary, and good grief. I guess get the earplugs out, get the hip boots, earplugs, maybe one of those clip clothes hangers for your nose, because it's going to come at you hard and heavy. Okay. Anyway, I wanted to mention a little bit about the cameras, and of course this has been brought up by other people. The cameras that were used on the moon had to perform some pretty amazing functions under some pretty amazing conditions. If you look at the photos of the astronauts using these, they're just holding them out there like you were at the Sunday afternoon picnic. So anyway, in the vacuum of space, very cold environment, very hot environment, rapidly changing, etc. And what's kind of spurred my interest in just mentioning this is that there was an article about a man who went many times to the South Pole. And his thing, which is really great, was photographing and filming the Aurora Borealis during the winter months. And of course, in the winter months, the tail is away from the sun, the Earth's basically comet tail, incorrectly called magneto tail. It's not a magneto tail. Magnetic fields simply don't exist in outer space all by their lonesome. They need electrical energy to drive them. And so anyway, it is an electrical, basically the same conditions as a plasma discharge comet. But be that as it may, this man goes to Antarctica every year, or frequently, and stays there so he can film the Aurora Borealis. And by the way, I have personally witnessed the Aurora Borealis in just what you would call extreme mode, having been raised in Minnesota and being up in Canada and pushing up close to the Arctic Circle when the auroras come down, and that's relatively frequently, especially in the month of August. I remember one night I was out by a lake, and the auroras just erupted into just unbelievable, shooting across the sky, all different colors, and there was a full moon. The Aurora Borealis was brighter than the full moon, if you can even imagine. I mean, it was just a spectacular light show, something that Hollywood could never, ever duplicate. So this man goes down to Antarctica to film the Aurora Borealis. But they were talking about the extreme conditions of his cameras. So he had to take regular cameras and modify them because of the extreme conditions down there. Well, the conditions in outer space are much more extreme than that. So the question is, how does film turn? This is back in the days of film, where you had film in the camera that had to roll, Mylar sheets that had the silver halides attached to it, etc., that would create the photos. So anyway, it's one of those little fun things that we wrestle with when imagining how they took these pictures and how these cameras worked. But the interesting thing is that some of these cameras are still available today. And so it would be interesting to imagine taking them into outer space, etc., no casing, no protection of any kind, and just see how they work. Just a quick note on the United Kingdom. Brexit, we're moving up here. February, March is next month. It's going to come racing by. This May lady is still in office, prime minister. And I said this before. I said, if she's still there, there will be no agreement of any kind. And, of course, the United Kingdom, there's a lot of fear-mongering going on about what's going to happen when they leave the European Union, which is slated for March 29th, coming up. And as long as May is in office, she's kind of, you know, the Brexit people have left her there. They could have called a vote of no confidence, but they realized that as long as she's in office, there won't be any kind of agreement made between the non-Brexit and the Brexit people. And, you know, the non-Brexit people are scrambling. They're flipping out. And this includes the bankers, because, good grief, the Bank of England goes way back. And the bankers over there, the bankers created the European Union to bring everybody into their banking fold. So for somebody like Britain to leave is a major blow to the European bankers. Okay, so anyway, by the way, it turns out that, and I have not confirmed this with other sources, but I've heard that Sweden is dropping the euro. Sweden is going on to another form of currency in the upcoming weeks. And so anyway, I would suggest if you're, you know, do finances or have business and things like that, go and verify that yourself, because my source, I would consider it reliable, but not 100% reliable. But there's a lot of activity. I would say as soon as England goes from the European Union, probably France, probably Germany would be next. And the benefit is, for example, a study was just done recently regarding what area of the world would be the number one trade area of the world, and it turns out to be Shanghai, China. So China is racing ahead at light speed into the future, and Trump came along at a time to try and salvage the United States. If not, we would have been simply toast. And China, you know, they belong in a sense to the European banker community, so they can trade, but they have a private accord with Russia. They have a private accord with Venezuela and many, many other countries which they trade with, in which they do not go through the SWIFT system, which is the European banker code system for transferring money internationally. So anyway, but I would agree with that from my own experience that Shanghai is going to be the very center, in spite of Taiwan and other rumblings. The Chinese are moving ahead, which brings me to this next story, that the Chinese are doing quite a bit in space. But there was an article, it was in a magazine called it was called spacenews.com, and it's a much better magazine, online magazine, than space.com, which is a basically NASA rah-rah rag. But the Space News is more oriented towards business and private business, and they have actually legitimate stories. But one article in there talked about how the Chinese were very much ahead of the United States. And, of course, I've been pounding on that topic for a long time. I talked about it in my book, The Diamond Principle, etc., and I'm going to be talking about that aspect of this in just a minute. But technically, the Chinese are not putting a lot of money into space military. There are some very rudimentary, crude space weapons that you can develop that are very effective. You just put a bunch of shrapnel bolts or nuts or whatever you want out in outer space in quantity, and just bring them in at basically 17,000 miles an hour, twice that if you're going in the opposite direction. And there's no spacecraft in the universe that's going to withstand a blast of material like that. So anyway, that's where they're going to stop. The Chinese are spending their time on commercial space ventures. And these are state-operated, of course. It takes a tremendous effort, a tremendous amount of engineering and manpower. But the Chinese have purchased a lot of their equipment from the Russians, and things like docking, where you dock two spacecraft and the people get out of one and go into the other one. The United States perfected that back in the 60s with the Gemini program. The Russians had beat us to the manned space program and doing those type of operations back in the 60s. And the Chinese simply bought that technology and are off and running. But it's very clear that the Chinese are very far ahead of the United States technically, in terms of technological prowess. The Chinese have a heavy lift rocket. They just had a failure, but that's the way it goes. You're going to have failures, and they are going to move on. The Chinese have nationwide stated that they have fallen way behind, that the United States, it's a national pride issue, and they have pushed into education, mathematics, science, physics, and kind of like what Kennedy did. There was a big push, in fact, when I went to school in physics when I was in college. That was part of the Kennedy initiative to bring education to the masses, because prior to that in the United States, for those of you that are old enough to remember, when I was in high school, that would have been the early 1960s, only the wealthy kids got to go to college. My parents never, ever imagined that I would go to college. My dad said, hey, you've got four options, the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines. That was the attitude. I mean, that was post-World War II, the baby boom. I won't give you my birth date, but my year was the biggest year of the baby boom after World War II. But like I say, the kids of dentists and doctors and attorneys went to college, and it was kind of a fun thing. They went to college, they partied, they came home and got a job at dad's business. And that's kind of the way it was when I was at Cornell. The students there, when I was teaching there, there was a lot of that attitude, but it was a hard school to go to. I mean, it was a rigorous school, but anyway, I'm not going to go into all of that right now. But the Chinese, let me just continue with the United States. So when I went to college, it was rough. I mean, it was difficult. I spent all my time, and I was at the top of my class in math and in physics, and always with A's. My GPA was perfect, and I had a double major. So that was not easy, and it was very difficult. And they didn't just give A's or B's. You had to get an A. After I left, I went back, and one of my professors, I talked to him a number of years after I left college. And the administration of the school said, hey, you're being too tough on these students. You have to score on a bell curve, meaning that somebody always had to get an A. And that's not the way it was when I went to school. I had to earn A's. I had a thesis that I worked in the laboratory, working with Auger electrons with a vacuum system. It was the head of our department, Dr. Donald Morgan, was a PhD physicist with a research background. And he was very strict, really strict. You did not mess around. I had an office in the physics building. Everybody did. They had their own space. And it was not easy. But then the United States just got all watered down. We got to mother our kids. We got to baby them. We got to give them grades. Got to make it easy. No. It's not. And so the United States fell way behind. And by the way, these schools, the California schools and the, you know, the Eastern schools that think they're real hoity-toity, the reality is, yeah, there's a lot of people coming out with good degrees, etc. But when it comes to space, the United States has got their head up their collective butt. Let me just put it that way. Because with NASA leading the way, they are, I mean, NASA doesn't know what it's doing. So when it comes to space, there are some fledgling companies that are just beginning to do things, but we have lost 50 years. When they celebrate the 50th year of NASA allegedly going to the moon, that's 50 years of lost time, money, resources that we will never get back. And it's continuing. They want to spend the next 20 years thinking about going someplace and putting three men someplace. The Chinese, as I said many times, by the time NASA gets to the moon again, if they ever do, with their little pod that looks a little bit bigger than an Apollo pod, and the astronauts step out on the moon, they can walk down the street and buy Chinese takeout. That's the scope. Anyway, the Chinese are very much ahead of us. But the point here, okay, so other people are starting to realize that. Good grief. Yeah, that's the way it is. Because we have lost. You know, we don't have a claim to the moon. If they did go there, they didn't stay. It's like any territory. If you go, you put a flag there, that's not yours. You got to stay there and defend it. So anyway, the moon is open territory. But here's the bigger issue. The people, the society of the United States, is not culturally adept at living in space. Our society does not cater to it. And the Chinese do. They have a collective society. Once you get into outer space, it's all different. And that's the point of my book, The Diamond Principle. The Diamond Principle, which, by the way, I am discussing in my lectures now in my paid cast. So is part of my ongoing series of discussions of my books. I just started in February the paid cast. I finished the Calculate Primes and Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. I finished that in January, and in February I'm starting on the Diamond Principle. But in the Diamond Principle, I wrote about society, the U.S. society, and the world in general. And in there I said, this is many years ago, I said China has the society, and they are going to push. China has a city where they bring all their engineers and students. And when you're in an environment like that, like when I was at college, St. Mary's College, and at Tulane, there was a culture in the physics department, and also in the math department. When I was at Cornell, there was a culture, although it was not a healthy culture, in the space science department, or in the physics. It was very snobbery at Cornell. But when I was in college, there was a culture, and when you are around people like that, they feed off of each other. You get a sense of other people working, and it makes you positive and working in that same direction. So China collectively has an impetus nationally to go into space. It's a national pride issue. They have also, in a sense, shamed themselves into understanding that they lost a lot of time. And now they are going for it. And when you see their equipment, it's good. It's top notch. So in right now, NASA can't even draw a picture of the rocket they want. They talk about building big rockets. It ain't going to happen. NASA's going out with all their money, They can't develop anything. And so it's going to be private space companies that simply go out and do things, and then NASA will hire them, making it look like NASA's doing something. But this is a big problem in the United States, and one of the core issues is education. Science and math education in the United States is horrific. It's terrible. We do not have the teaching staff in the high schools, in grade school and high school, to bring our students up to any kind of semblance of level with Chinese, Japanese, Russian. Russians are far ahead also. And the Russians are great at building tremendously sophisticated systems with very few resources. Because in the United States, every executive has got to, you know, have his $2 million house down on that beach north of San Diego. Anyway, or down in Houston or wherever. Okay, enough of that. I first want to, before going on, I forgot last week to mention that my MR7, this is the new version of, remember I had the MR500 and MR900 before. These were the whole house filters, and they sold very well. But now I've changed the housing on these. This is now a stainless steel housing. It's the same filter package. The only difference is we went from a plastic to a stainless steel housing. And the price has gone up a little bit because, mainly because this is 7 filter elements instead of 5. And so mainly what I was selling before was the MR5. And at the end, if you remember, I was selling the MR9 for $600 more than the MR5, just because we ran out of the MR5s and we had a few MR9s left on the shelf. So now the concentration is on the MR7. The MR5, for some applications, was a little too small. The MR9 was a little too big, so we put it right in the middle, MR7. So this is the one model that I'm going to concentrate on. It's always better to have one model that is kind of fits all in terms of stocking and et cetera. But it's the same. It's a 3-filter package. It's the initial filter that removes sediment, then the main filter that has 7 of the 20-inch. These are big. These are 20-inch. Filter elements, and then at the end is an ultraviolet filter that kills any biological mini things like viruses, etc., that might get through the filtration system. So this is a whole house filter, can be used for commercial. It lets the minerals go through. So if you, for example, have a problem with hard water, you would have to put, and you would have to do this anyway, you would have to put a water softener first before the MR7, because the minerals, literally, the MR7 is just like my other GF filters. They are targeted filtration. They remove a targeted set of contaminants, and minerals are not contaminants. They're simply a nuisance. And so if you have bad minerals, you know, high mineral content in your water, then you would have to get a water softener. The MR7 is not a water softener. And I want to make that clear. It's a water filter, and there's a lot of people out there trying to sell you a whole house filter that they call it a filter, but it's all it is a water softener. It takes, or it might have some charcoal in it that removes chlorine. So don't be fooled by people trying to sell you something with just charcoal. All that's going to remove is the chlorine. Okay, so anyway, the retail price on this unit is $39.95. And so the and there will be a discount when you go to my sales page. There will be a discount. So go to the sales page. It's the jmccsci.com. Click on the sales page, and then you'll see the discounts, etc., and they're healthy discounts. And if you buy the replacement filter kit, one of them or two of them or three or four, some people buy more, So they have their replacement filters for all time. But these things last for 40 to 80,000 gallons before you have to replace the filter elements. So these last years and years and years before you have to replace the filter elements. But it's always good to have that filter element packed there when it comes time to replace them. And so you can measure. Most houses have a water meter that measures your water. And if you don't have one, you can easily put one in your water line. Some people, by the way, install these themselves. We recommend a professional installation with a plumber. They're easy to install, a couple hours, and they're installed. So if you know what you're doing, you can install these no problem at all. Okay, but at any rate, we also include free shipping to the 48 states. Hawaii and Alaska, unfortunately, the shipping there is pretty outrageous, so we have to charge the customer just like with foreign orders. Okay, just another quick note. My new release is coming next week. My newest book coming out, and of course I don't pre-announce titles or topics. It'll be announced on the John Moore Show next Wednesday, February 13th. That's 8 o'clock in the morning Central Time on RBN, Republic Broadcasting Network, on the John Moore Show. And so we'll be releasing the name. But this book is for sale in pre-sale, and the benefit of pre-sale is that you get the book for a little bit lower price. The price is going to go up the day of the release. And also, you'll get the release on the day of the release. If you wait, then you will have to wait for your email. It's a downloadable product. And so at any rate, that's the, and it also helps me out. So in the pre-sale, and it's always kind of fun to see people, how many people actually order in the pre-sale, because I'm one of the few people maybe on the planet that can sell a book where people have not heard the name or the title or the topic, and people are buying it. In fact, I've had people go, you know, you're selling the book and people are buying it and they don't know what the title is. And I go, yeah, I've been doing this since back in the early 2000s when I started the Planet X series books and the Atlantis to Tesla book, etc. And so that's a vote of confidence for me also. It's kind of fun to see the people ordering when they don't know what the title's going to be. They have enough confidence in me that they know it's going to be good. So, okay, you can go to the webpage also and order that. There's various ways. If you purchase more than $350 worth of products, you get the book free. Anyway, that's all on the webpage. And then join the paid cast, please. That's something that helps me out. It's for you, it's $3.95 a month. You get an extra weekly lecture, and believe me, they are worth it. They are blockbuster. So join the paid cast, and if you know people that might like to join, send them to the page to also join the paid cast. $3.95 a month. But collectively, that helps me because I don't have donors, I don't have sponsors, I don't have all of those other things. I don't have government money coming under the table like some websites that compete against me, that steal my material, etc. Let me just, okay, so enough of that. Go to the webpage, all of that there. This story is ridiculous, and I have to waste some of my showtime. We call it fear porn. And that's really the only thing you can call it. Now, there's been a story circulating in the mainstream press that the Earth's magnetic field is racing towards Russia, as if, oh no, we're going to lose the North Pole to Russia. I've heard things. And then I saw an article, it was in Veterans Today. I don't know who's what they're smoking over there, but it was an article saying that the Earth's magnetic field was going to flip and there's going to be all kinds of devastation and, you know, pack your bags and get your get-out bag ready because the world is going to end. And no, let me explain something. The Earth's magnetic field has been moving towards the North Pole. It's now just north of the Northwest Territories of Canada. And this year, it moved a little more than it did the last year. And so what's going on, let me explain. We had a physical pole shift. Now, there we have the physical pole, the rotational pole, and then there's the magnetic pole. And the magnetic pole, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, was concurrent with the geographical, the rotational north pole of Earth, and that was in the north of, in the state of Ontario, the province of Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. And after that, then we had a pole shift because a large comet came through the solar system and became the planet Venus. This is very clear. And of course, modern science is so off the wall. They, you know, the goofy science that people are being taught is just that. It's just ludicrous. But then you get this nonsense, and these are planted articles just to bring the people astray. That, the world's going to end. There's going to be a magnetic pole shift. Let me explain something. We have a magnetic pole shift 2 to 3 times every month, and nobody dies. Most people don't even know about it because the solar wind, the majority of our magnetic field is a plasma magnetic field, and when the solar wind comes in with a reversed magnetic field, which happens actually quite often, it can actually reverse our magnetic field here on Earth. And so that happens frequently. It's just that if you had a magnet down sitting at your desk, that magnet is sensing the geomagnetic field that is in the Earth. And there again, they keep pushing this idea that the Earth's core rotates and therefore there's currents set up. That's just hogwash. Absolute hogwash. What's going on is that the moon has an electric field. It's basically a comet nucleus out there next to Earth. It's discharging the solar capacitor, just like Io of Jupiter, just like Dione of Saturn. These satellites, moons, are locked. They're in orbit, and they're also creating an electric field and discharging to the mother planet, in this case, Earth with our moon. And that's what drives our magnetic field. And there's some of the Earth's magnetic field is locked into iron and nickel deposits that are in the Earth, and that is the permanent magnetic field of Earth, but it is also very small. And so the Earth's magnetic field is changing because the Earth is relaxing. It's getting back to a normal state after a very devastating event that happened in the last 10,000 years, where we did have about a 30-degree pole shift. And Velikovsky talks about this, but there again, in standard science, the United States is so ridiculously out of touch with any reality. They're trying to tell you, by the way, in terms of weather, I talk in my weather work about hurricanes being formed from electrical currents from the ionosphere. And of course, standard science still tries to tell you that hurricanes and cyclonic storms are caused by warm water. Well, this past week, there was a cyclonic storm that set off the southern shore of Greenland all week. It was a hurricane, literally a hurricane, some of the coldest water on the planet Earth. And, of course, the weather media never mentioned a word about this. I'll also reiterate, there is no such thing as a polar vortex. Polar vortex is a new term that the kind of what you might call a sexy term for the weather people to get attention. Because remember, the weather news is trying to get your attention. And when they get your attention, their ratings go up. When their ratings go up, their sponsors pay more money. And when their sponsors pay more money, they get paid more money. So this is an economic thing. And so when they say polar vortex, they say, oh, everybody's watching because they think there's some kind of new thing going on causing this very cold weather that we had over the past weeks. No, this happens all the time. It was when I was a little kid, we called it the Alberta Clipper. in Minnesota. And because the wind would come down across Alberta from the North Pole and across Minnesota. And Minnesota was right in the center of it all the time. So you get the cold, the snow, the wind. And I grew up with that. And there was no polar vortex. Believe me, polar vortex is a modern term. It's you're going to see a lot more of this. Where you, I think the implication is that this is somehow tied to global warming. And, good grief. Good grief. I mean, between magnetic pole shifts and global climate change, the public is so ill-informed, so, they don't understand science because they have not been taught science. They've been taught phrases and emotion in the newspapers. That's the science that you get in the United States. And so that's why people don't know anything. So people run around jumping up and down, repeating things, and it has nothing to do with real science. That's why people listen to this show, is to get at least a semblance of sanity when it comes to science, weather, magnetic pole shifts, whatever that it might be out there. Okay. Now, here's an article that a lot of people wrote in and asked me to comment on, and you may have seen this in the fake news, science news press out there, but this story actually has a little bit of a validity, which is interesting. That's very rare. But some Japanese scientists published a paper, I think it was in Nature, and they can publish some things there that are good, that our Milky Way galaxy is warped. Now, warped galaxies are common. I think it's like 1 in 7 galaxies of all the billions of galaxies that we've seen out in the universe. 1 out of 7 or something like that is warped. So it's not something that's like you would think, oh my goodness, our galaxy is warped. There's something wrong. We're all going to die. Well, no, not at all. So a warped galaxy is nothing unusual. But what they did was they measured the distance to Cepheid variables. Now, these are types of stars that the very interesting methodology for measuring distance in outer space. And so these stars, which are variable, you can find them out in the galaxy and then use them basically as a roadmap to understand the distances to various points, in this case, out in the galaxy. So I haven't looked at all of the science, but it looks like it's based on at least sound science, the use of Cepheid variables to measure distances, and as opposed to redshifts, which is totally bogus. The use of redshift to measure distance is totally bogus, and I explain this in my papers when I talk about my theoretical work and the laboratory verifiable induced electric dipole redshift. Okay, so I think the jury's still out on this. This is one of the few initial papers on this. In fact, I saw another paper a number of years ago where they said that the Milky Way galaxy might have 3 arms instead of 2. It might have 4 arms. The unusual situation here, however, is we cannot see with any form of observation, X-rays, gamma rays, cosmic rays, visible light, infrared, microwave. We cannot see the other side of the galaxy. So we're very limited. We're very fortunate in that we live on the very outskirts of our own Milky Way galaxy. And this means the distance between stars is very great. And we are just sitting out here in the middle of nowhere in the boondocks, but we have very good visibility of the night sky, which if you lived much farther in the galaxy in, a star cluster, you would not have good visibility of very much at all. You probably wouldn't even know that there was a galaxy out here. You probably would not know that there are billions of galaxies in the universe. And so their view of the universe might be very limited. But the other flip side of that is that They may have been starfaring, in other words, able to move to other stars much sooner than we would, because our nearest star is like, a little over four light years away, and the average nearby star is 6 to 12 light years away. So not exactly an easy trek for your first venture out into the galaxy, out away from our own star system. But if you lived in a star cluster much closer to the center of the galaxy, you would the night sky would be blazing with stars. And so you would have 24/7 light is the problem. So your night times would not be dark is the point. So it would very much limit your ability to see. Anyway, is our galaxy warped? There might be some indication of that. Pretty esoteric topic. But, okay, so on to another topic about electricity. This is the Noor Solar Complex. It's in Africa. It's the biggest solar energy system. It covers 3,000 hectares. Now, a hectare, if you're familiar with acres, a hectare is about 2.5 acres. So if you're used to acres in the United States, many other countries use hectares, which is a metric unit, and it's about 2.5 acres. So 3,000 hectares would be around 7,500 acres. This is a solar farm which has mirrors, not solar panels, but mirrors, and produces, what they do is they focus each mirror, gets at an angle where it focuses its light up to a tower. Now, this tower is something like 250 meters, so about 800 feet tall, and then at the very top is the focus point where all of the sun, these mirrors reflect the sun, and it produces, they say, 580 megawatts, which is about the equivalent of a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired, average-sized coal-fired power plant. Some of the big coal plants get up to around four times that. But the interesting thing about this type of facility, a solar reflecting array as opposed to solar panels, is that it can store energy in the heat. So they can store a certain amount of energy and then release it at a later time, which is a benefit. But there again, the cost of this is humongous. The cost of this facility is over the top. So it's really huge. They say it can power 1 million homes, but that's at the nameplate value. And so anyway, this is a very expensive facility, but it's better than solar panels in that it can store energy and release that energy into electricity at a later time. But certainly does not compare with the wing generator. The wing generator is going to cost far less to produce those same 580 megawatts of power for the large ones. Okay, but on to the next topic. Electric cars. This week, I took a little time out of my busy schedule and was looking at e-cars. And that's the wave of the future. And what's interesting is these cars, when you get to like the Formula E, the Formula race cars, the kind that they use like in Monaco or those types of races, these are cars that are like the highest performance automobiles on the planet. And now they're going to electric. And the electric cars are so high performance, they just wipe the petroleum cars, the fire-breathing cars, off the map. And so they actually have to have limiters. So now they have rules that a car cannot pass another car. It is limited on the amount of power it can expend in its engine when it's on the field, because if they just let these things out there and roll out, I mean, they're like jet airplanes. By the way, there was an announcement also that I think it's called the F-115, which is an advanced fighter plane, is going to be electric. I believe that has been publicly announced now. So our next very high-end jet aircraft is going to be electric. In other words, electric fan jets in place of petroleum-burning, petroleum-based fuels. Very interesting. So this is coming, commercial airliners, etc. But the advancements in batteries, and I said this before, if I had more time, I would be working on this myself. But it's a very esoteric topic in science, and the people that work in this are truly chemists and physical chemists, etc. But the big problem with batteries today and battery storage is that about 95% of the energy that is used to charge the batteries goes up in heat. In other words, when you charge your cell phone, you probably have noticed this. You put your cell phone over by the plug, you plug in, and you charge up your cell phone, that lithium-ion battery in there. And you get done charging, you pick up your phone, it's hot. That's because you are wasting energy in heat. Not all of that energy in the coming out of the wall socket going into your phone, it's translated into DC in that little plug. It's a DC AC to DC converter. And then it charges your phone. And when it's done, the new ones turn off. But the heat expended is pretty high. Now, when you use the phone, you might notice, too, if you're using your phone a lot, it heats up also. And that's the reverse process. Getting the energy back out of your phone causes heat also. So this wasted energy in heat is very excessive. And it's usually in the junctions where there's the element, that little micro, sub-microscopic elements that store the energy. And then there's the interface where the energy comes in and out. And it's in that interface where the energy is expended when charging and discharging. So the person that discovers how to get around that heat loss is going to be pretty famous and wealthy. So that's being worked on. And when it happens, all of a sudden, and I say my prediction is within the next 3 years, maybe sooner, somebody's going to crack that nut scientifically. Then the amount of energy you can store in a battery per unit weight is going to go way down. And all of a sudden, airplanes with batteries, typically batteries are pretty heavy for the amount of energy they put out. And they, for a unit of weight, here's the critical thing, the unit of weight for energy storage in batteries is much lower than that of petroleum. So petroleum is a much more efficient fuel when it comes to transportation, whether it's automobiles, bicycles, motorcycles, trains, whatever. But with land vehicles, weight does not matter as much because you've got wheels to hold it up. Once you get that battery moving along with the car or the train or whatever, when you stop the train, you can take that energy and put it back into the battery. So that's a way of recuperating that energy because of the heavy mass. But in either case, the energy is lost due to this heating problem. So like I say, the person that comes up with the solution to that is going to be the person who is going to be very famous, wealthy. And let me just give you another example of somebody who did solve a similar problem. There was the old incandescent light bulbs. 95%, this is the old Edison light bulb, where you have a filament in there, a filament of wire that heats up and creates light. Well, you have to heat it up pretty high, and you have to do that in a vacuum because if it was in air, it would burn up, it would vaporize, it would oxidize. But in the absence of oxygen, that filament will last a long time. And so anyway, they created the incandescent light bulb, the vacuum light bulb. and about 95% of the energy used to create that light went up as heat. And so, in fact, they say in a room, if you were in a party, say with a big hall with a lot of people, they actually would calculate the amount of energy given off per person, the amount of heat energy, as equivalent to a 100-watt light bulb burning. Well, somebody came along with the bright idea that you take an LED, it's a semiconductor device that gives off light, and then you coat it with a phosphate coating. It's a chemical composition. And what it does is it takes that heat and it translates it into light. Very interesting. And so now we have LED light bulbs, which are a tenth the amount of energy to give you the same amount of light. So somewhere along the line, somebody got the bright idea of how to create a light bulb that does not use as much energy, that does not have as much heat loss. But now we have this problem, and always have had this problem, with batteries. So the person that cracks that nut scientifically, the engineer who comes up with this solution, is going to be, this is going to break the entire back of the petroleum industry and all of this posturing that's going on right now. In fact, the wing generator is going to break the petroleum industry. There's no question about it. It's coming, and in the next 10 years, you're going to see wing generators all over the place. And as long as I'm talking about this topic, here's something that this past week, a man died in a hospital because his e-cigarette blew up in his face. Now, this is the second time. There's another story, and I'm not an expert on this. I have not followed this. I just read an article. But there was another man that died 6 months ago from an e-cigarette blowing up in his face. So I guess my advice is, if you got to smoke, take your chances with cancer and smoke a real cigarette. At least it's not going to blow up in your face. Yeah. And so there again, that's a case of the battery in there overheating, causing, and of course, part of what the e-cigarette does is it heats up the liquid to a vapor point, and then that's what the people breathe. And you can, I guess some have nicotine, some have lower levels of nicotine, so you can wean yourself off the nicotine habit. That's the idea. But putting something in your mouth that can potentially explode, probably not a good idea. Here's a story. You should have your passwords written down. Here's a guy that had a company. It was a cryptocurrency company, and he had over 100,000 users, and there was something like $145 million in his little company that he ran out of his basement, and or maybe his bedroom, I don't know, but out of his house. And he's at age 30 suddenly died, and he was the only person that knew the password. So there's $145 million worth of cryptocurrency locked up into God knows where, his laptop, and 100,000 of his clients cannot get their money out. So in this whole crypto world is becoming rather scary. A little fun fact here is I learned recently that the United States banking system will not allow you to purchase cryptocurrency offshore outside the United States. The banks will simply block the sale. You can't do it. So there's a law in place to block U.S. citizens from purchasing foreign-based cryptocurrencies. I guess they have to allow it in the United States, which I imagine they could block too, because it's not a coin of the realm. It's not a dollar. It's not an authorized monetary system. But the reality is, my belief is that the world bankers are the ones actually pushing cryptocurrency and allowing it to happen, because if this were invading their money world, they would absolutely not want it. And so cryptocurrency is bringing us into a one-world cashless society in which all of your money is locked up into a computer system, and then you're going to have a little card that you walk around with, and they will decide on one cryptocurrency, as Sweden is doing, is from what I understand. They're going to have one cryptocurrency for the entire world, and then if you're not politically correct, you could have all your funds locked up, and you would not be able to literally buy, sell, or trade. And this is, this is predicted in the Old Testament that there would be a number. Everybody would have a number under the, you know, the futuristic banking system. And they're talking about this in the Old Testament, and they say, "Don't take the number." And this is, one of the end day prophecies. So anyway, it looks like we're inching towards that day when there will be a single currency system, non-cash cryptocurrency system for the entire world. So my estimation is that the world bankers do not want any private cryptocurrencies that are owned by anybody or controlled by anybody but themselves. So what they're going to do is they're going to let the market play and play out and then see who the winners are, who has the best system. And then they're going to go take that and take it over. And then everybody will have to use this same system. And, of course, one of the alleged benefits of cryptocurrency is that half the people in the world don't use banking. They don't have a bank account. And so if you could take these, you know, 3.5 billion people and line them up and just put a like stamp on them, and all of a sudden they can start making trades and buying, etc., and earning money into their account, it would easily bring in, imagine having 3.5 billion new customers for bubblegum or cell phones or rice or whatever. There's a system in India now where people have a credit card-like card, and they go to a machine where they get water. They have to, that's where they, instead of walking down the road and getting it from a puddle, they now can go to some machine that will give them relatively clean water. And they put their card in, and that card can be either prepaid or paid for by government programs, etc. But it's training the people that you go down to this machine, and that's where you get your water. And I'm almost out of time here. Just a couple other mentions. Remember the MR7, the new stainless steel whole house water filter, now available for sale on my webpage. There's still a 15% off pricing on the while my water filter products, the major ones, and my new release coming out in another week, available at pre-release sale on my webpage. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.